I'll take the moderator's prerogative, and we'll then call on people for follow-up questions. But my first question for you is, you specifically talked a lot about charity and about the private sector, both of which are critically important. And indeed, Undersecretary Levy is out in the region right now and has already come out with some public statements on the fact that charities continue to be abused and that there are still major donors engaged in this kind of illicit activity. As you noted, Treasury has done outreach to the charitable sector, which has been received well by some and less so by others, and is now very, very active engaging the private sector and the financial community. One of the things that I get asked a lot when I go to New York and elsewhere as a former Treasury official is, how can the private sector fully do all that is expected of it and really all that it could do if it doesn't have access to all the information necessary? And I wanted to ask you if it's even possible, or if it's being given any thought, for Treasury or others to kind of replicate kind of what the Department of Defense does in terms of being able to provide clearances to contractors who work on a whole variety of DOD-related issues far outside the Pentagon, to be able to provide compliance officers, for example, in the financial community, some type of access to further classified information so that they know what to look for and can further facilitate that dialogue. Your comment on that, and then we'll open up for further questions.
That's a great point, and you do see, in a variety of contexts, government sharing sensitive information with the private sector. I think one good example is critical infrastructure protection. I know FBI and others, DHS, work with IT professionals in critical industries to try to share some of the threats and so forth. This is a topic that we are struggling with continually. It's something we would be very interested in expanding. The exact form it'll take, you know, I can't precisely predict. I will say that it's not always classified information. So we do, and I think our targeted actions actually serve part of this function by putting more information out into the private sector. You see, for example, many banks around the world, even when they're not legally required to consult the OFAC list or to take that into consideration, they do so just because it's another source, another piece of information for them to make sound business judgments on the activity in their institution. So I would agree with you. We will continue through targeted measures to put information out. As I mentioned, sometimes our informal approach on a specific in a specific context will be to quietly go to an institution, and we would like to make that more systemic to the extent we can. I will say, I know one thing that FinCEN is working on. They've done some analysis about the SAR reporting with respect to terrorist financing, and I think they have found that there's a good 20% or so. Oh, SAR is a suspicious activity reporting. These are the reports that banks will file when they see transactions that don't seem to make sense or appear suspicious. And we do hear this from the private sector, particularly with respect to terrorist financing. They'll say, we know how to find money laundering. You know, money laundering, more by definition, is there's an illicit source of the money. Sometimes with terrorist financing, it might be legitimately earned money through some other source, but it's being used for a terrorist purpose. And you'll hear from the private sector, how can we pick that out? It's interesting, though, FinCEN has seen there's about a 20% correlation. If you looked at the body of terrorist financing SARs, there's about a 20% correlation rate with open FBI terrorism investigations. So the private sector is doing pretty well in identifying some of these things. What we need to do is do some additional analysis on that 20%, find some of the indicators that may present themselves in that body, maybe look at the compliance and other internal procedures of some of the organizations that were getting a good hit rate, and maybe we can share some of those indicators and best practices to improve the private sector's ability.
We have a lot of questions, and we'll get to everyone, I promise. Let's start over here, please. If you could speak into the mic on your table.
In an effort to move from the general, which you concentrated on, to specific interesting situations, what was the upshot of the meeting held in Paris last month with Iran? Are there other meetings planned? why wasn't it disclosed? Isn't there a benefit to tell the American public and to tell the Iranian public and to tell the Europeans and whoever that you're inquiring into Iran's activities or whatever you did? It is not known what happened at that, what transpired at that meeting, as far as I know, if it's one in a series, and so forth and so on. So please tell us what you think the public is entitled to know about that.
When inquiries came up about this, Treasury released a statement about it.
Generally nothing.
Yeah, well,
but the Iranians said less.
I think the meeting has been mischaracterized as a meeting between the U.S. and Iran. As our statement pointed out, the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, it's an international body of over 30 countries that their primary role is to develop standards and implementation of money laundering and terrorist financing controls. These standards that I've talked about in my remarks, generally they're coming from the FATF. They also have these regional bodies that I mentioned. The FATF itself, as a body, over 30 countries, have a process underway to look at a number of jurisdictions, not based on specific proliferation or terrorism activity, but on the legal framework that's in place for money laundering and terrorist financing concern, the supervision in different jurisdictions, their ability to enforce these laws. So they are looking systemically at money laundering and terrorist financing regimes in a variety of different countries. It was in that context that that the meeting arose. It was in that context, as part of the work of the FATF and that this FATF statement that I mentioned, the jurisdictional warning that they put out on Iran, came about. So I just think that the meeting has been mischaracterized as some bilateral engagement between the U.S. and Iran. And we engage in a multitude of different multilateral bodies that will have some interaction with Iran, the UN, others.
Were there no bilateral talks? I understand. It's a larger setting with some countries. The Americans and the Iranians didn't sit down bilaterally and talk about Iran's activities?
No.
All right. I think that was asked and answered. Right here, we're going to make our way around.
I have a FATF-related question. I believe that FATF has not officially designated any countries to be out of compliance with, like, when they do their investigations. And correct me if I'm wrong. If they have, it's been very few. Can you go into that and see, I mean, if that's why that is and if that's an indicator that FATF, you know, is more of a paper tiger than any kind of significant international enforcement regime?
No. I think what you're referring to, earlier, I guess it would be more in the 2003 time, several years ago, there was a whole series of efforts within the FATF to develop what was called the non-conforming countries list, the NCCT process, it was called, NCCT. And a number of countries were identified as having inferior money laundering and terrorist financing regimes. And a number of countries, in the Philippines, Burma, a number of others were put onto this list. There was then a series of engagements by this international organization, the FATF, with those jurisdictions and its members, because the G7 are very prominent members within FATF and provide a lot of technical support, et cetera. These countries have been working their way off the list since then. That initial effort was completed. And so there's a new effort underway to begin, once again, to start assessing jurisdictions. So I think you'll see continuing work from the FATF on a variety of jurisdictions, but the process is just slightly different than it was back in that earlier initial effort. Yes?
Or I'll just say, for those in the back, everyone here has a mic. Those in the back want to ask questions. If you could just come towards the mic, it would be easy to call you. Let's go over here right now. Yeah.
Yes, and that's a good question. And the question, if you couldn't hear it, was with some of the recent designations with respect to Syrian and Lebanese figures, what impact, if they don't have assets in the United States, does that have? I guess I'd just turn back to a couple of the comments I made earlier where financial institutions across the world look at the OFAC list and often incorporate it automatically into their computer systems to flag transactions that might bump against some of the names that are on our list. Now, other jurisdictions, if you're not a U.S. person, you don't have a legal obligation to take any specific action. But banks are always looking for additional information to make informed decisions. So I think that's an example of, first of all, it does have legal effect here in the U.S., but even beyond that, it puts information out into the international private sector for them to make their own decisions about the types of clientele and the business that they want to have. And I guess it's a forum to put some of these issues out into the public space, and we can use that as part of our effort to talk to other countries, to talk in other multilateral forum to try to get consensus for some multilateral type of action.
Flint?
Thank you. Flint Leverick from the New America Foundation. A day or so ago, the Wall Street Journal ran a story that as part of the Treasury Department's ongoing efforts to increase financial pressure on Iran, one option that's apparently being considered is to designate the central bank of Iran. And I was wondering if you would care to comment on that story, that would be very interesting. If you didn't want to comment on the story directly, I was hoping you might be willing to talk about are there policy and or legal issues involved with designating a country's central bank for financial sanctions that go above and beyond whatever policy and legal issues you need to deal with if you're going to designate some other sort of financial institution in Iran. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I will not comment. I will not speculate on future actions and what's being considered, et cetera. And I think that I would extend that to a discussion about the considerations that would go into that kind of decision-making process. So I think we'll move to the next question.
Yes. In the spirit of the focus on specifics in Iran, I thought it would be helpful to ask you, and I don't know what you can answer in this setting, about continuing money flows from the Gulf states to al-Qaeda and Taliban operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, first of all, what can you tell us in this setting about the nature of the money flows that are occurring? And where are the weak spots now? I know a lot of work has gone into trying to improve Saudi Arabian banking formal and informal monitoring and tracking of financial transactions. But where are the weak spots that you're able to tell us here? And given the massive amounts of money flows occurring in Afghanistan from, for example, the narco trafficking operations, what can you tell us about efforts being made by the U.S. government to crack down on the money flows that are so important to funding the Taliban?
Okay. I guess maybe first a general comment about the Gulf. I think what you'll find as you look at the money laundering and terrorist financing frameworks that are in place, actually many of the jurisdictions, you know, have pretty decent laws on the books. I think what we see is not the kind of strong implementation of those standards as we would like. So I think that is true as a general matter within the Gulf. As far as key area, the Gulf remains a primary source of funding for al-Qaeda and other Sunni extremist groups. We also see significant funds from the Gulf going to the Taliban. And we have talked in a variety of contexts about some of our concerns with particular countries there and so forth. I will say with respect to Saudi Arabia, I would put some of the context into context some of the statements that I think have been repeated about that Stuart Levy has made. And I would just say that that we do recognize the advances that Saudi Arabia has made on the counterterrorism front since they were attacked in May of 2003. I think what we would say, though, is that the focus of those efforts have been on threats internal to the kingdom. And on specifically on terrorist financing, there have been arrests, particularly over the last year. We welcome those. We think those have been a good thing. But once again, the focus of those activities have been with respect to threats within the kingdom, as opposed to financing of activity outside of the kingdom. And so we continue to work very vigorously with the Saudis to try to bring some of the effort that's been focused on internal threats to extend that into the external, and to hopefully add an element of public accountability, be it through prosecutions or designations, an element of public accountability into the efforts that they're making. Yeah, and then on Afghanistan, you know, there's a number of different flows that you have to look at. As I mentioned, there are Gulf-based flows that go in support. But as you mentioned, I think significant levels of funding that are coming from the narcotics trade, from particularly protection and other kind of security agreements. Also, you see kidnapping. You see it in Iraq, but you also see it in Afghanistan. Kidnapping and other kind of criminal extortion type activities providing significant funding flows to the Taliban. And on that front, clearly we have a big effort, interagency effort, and it's a multilateral effort on the narcotics side. And you know, DEA and the military, the Brits are very involved trying to get at narcotics flows, because Europe really sees a lot of that Afghan heroin. But then all the other efforts that we have within Afghanistan to build their legal system, to build all of their institutions of civil society, you know, go towards, you know, building capacity there to start getting at the narcotics problem, as well as the reconstruction teams trying to create other economic opportunity for folks. It's a big issue. It's a complex problem, and the one that we're working very hard.
Talked about the new banking measures against Iran. I wonder, have you seen any impact in terms of the social services that Hezbollah provides in Lebanon, or support for militias in Iraq, that would lead you to believe that these measures against Iranian banks are really accomplishing what you want them to accomplish? Aren't these sanctions actually hurting legitimate Iranian business more than they're hurting the IRGC? And you mentioned cash transactions and so on. It appears that Iran is compensating through cash and through going through second and third tier banks, particularly in Asia. I wonder if you comment on that. Thank you.
As far as the impact, I think we do see an impact. I think there's a lot in the public space about a tightening of trade finance for Iranian entities. If you're talking about building a nuclear and missile program, I mean, these are sophisticated pieces of equipment and material that you need, and the way traditionally to finance those has been through trade finance. So I do think that there is an impact. It makes that procurement more difficult. There has been some commentary about, are you hurting the rank and file more? I would say, you know, look at the economic mismanagement of Iran as a whole. I mean, you have got the macroeconomic factors that would contribute to inflation and so forth. I mean, you know, there's been turnover in their central bank. They set interest rates not based on market conditions, but on government dictates. So I think to the extent average Iranians are having a struggle in their daily life because of inflation and other issues, I think that's more attributed to macroeconomic decisions that the government is making rather than our targeted actions.
What is your take on the Middle East relations with the group? There are certain Iranian banks that were designated by your department under terrorism and supporting Iran's nuclear program. Those two banks were mentioned last October, and many part of those banks in the Gulf states, and what's the level of cooperation of Qatar, the UAE, and Bahrain in terms of stopping this funding curve?
As to the specific institution that you're referencing, I won't make any comments or talk about anything that's under consideration. As more of a general question of what kind of cooperation do we see in the Gulf? I think there has been reporting, if you look at the regional press, about even in Dubai, for example, this tightening of the letter of credit market and trade financing market that I've spoken about. I think one challenge that we face, I mean, clearly they are very much in the neighborhood, and there are historic ties between the Gulf countries and Iran, and you do see activity where there's an effort, I think, to move towards intermediaries and opening up front companies and so forth. So we're working very hard with all of those jurisdictions. I think Matt mentioned that Under Secretary Levy is in the region actually as we speak, working through some of these issues. So we've engaged them quite a bit. I think we've seen progress, but it's one that requires constant attention.
Thanks, Matt. Firas Maqsad of the Lebanon Renaissance Foundation. I want to follow up on Amal's question about Syria. Mm-hmm. There's a feeling out there that the U.S., but Treasury in specific, is limited in terms of its leverage vis-a-vis Syria, beyond designating just individuals. I would add to that by saying that Syria has also taken a number of actions to hedge against possible designations and possible sanctions. I wonder if you'd be able to comment about the leverage Treasury has vis-a-vis Syria and some of the policy tools it might have to do away with some of the more harmful actions Syria has been taking, whether in Lebanon or other countries.
Because Syria is not as integrated into kind of the international financial community, certainly not integrated into the U.S. Financial system, It poses a different situation for us than other types of entities or countries that much may be more integrated. That said, as we've discussed, I do think that the kinds of actions that we have been pursuing do have the ability, particularly through the private sector, to have an impact. And I also mentioned in my comments the Section 311 action that we took on the Commercial Bank of Syria and its subsidiary. So, the more interaction that we have, obviously, the more tools that there are for us. Even though that economic relationship is not strong, we still think there are value to some of the tools that we have, and we'll keep doing kind of what we can do to add to an international discussion. But clearly, additional pressure or more significant pressure would be benefited from, you know, a multilateral type of action.
Hi, I'm Eitan Alusi from RJI Capital. I have two major questions. First of all, what is your opinion about the financial jihad that Al-Qaeda declared on the United States? And to be more on the ground level, what do you think about the growing Sharia financing of the banking sector and the growing cases of companies or entities from the Middle East that buy parts of U.S. banks, such as Citibank, for an example? Mm-hmm. The second question is regarding, it's a more general question, how much do we know how much terrorism financing is in the world generally, and how much are we able or manage to capture? Thank you.
There's a lot of questions there. Yeah, well, I'll start with your the first question about Al-Qaeda's, financial jihad. I guess what I say there, I think the financial sector of the U.S. has been a target for Al-Qaeda. Obviously, we saw that in 9/11 and before that, and I think that will remain the case. Your second question, I'm sorry.
How much terrorism financing?
Oh. No, I don't. I think that'd be a good project for Matt and the team here at the Institute to try to put
anymore.
A figure on that. I couldn't put a figure on that. I'm sorry. Oh, that was it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't think that there is an inherent danger of Sharia finance per se. I mean, these products have been around, a long time. I don't see that just because you have an Islamic bank or a Sharia compliant product that that's an immediate, red flag necessarily. I mean, you see London, for example, being really growing as an Islamic finance center. So I do think there hasn't been kind of the same demand here in the U.S., a market for those products. They are offered in the U.S., but not to the extent that you see other places. I think it's one we'll have to I think the demand here will dictate whether we'll see more of that in our everyday life here in the U.S. But, like, for example, in our private sector dialogue that we've done with the region that I mentioned, we have a lot of Islamic banks that participate in that. And it's actually kind of a group that we want to recruit to participate because I think our institutions want to learn more about that and get into it. So I think it's something you'll see more and more of. And as far as the investments from overseas, I think primarily you've seen, capital infusions and kind of more passive investments. Treasury is doing a lot of work on sovereign wealth funds, and there are others at Treasury much more into the details of some of those issues. I know that we've tried to work on a set of principles that would guide kind of the transparency of the operation of those funds. The general concern is that the funds would operate not out of commercial interest, but out of some kind of political interest. So I think we've been working on a set of principles that would demonstrate more of a transparent nature of the funds, which is true whether it's a Chinese fund or a fund in the Middle East or what have you. And I know our deputy secretary is very active in that. Our international affairs group, Clay Lowry and Dave McCormick, and they could kind of probably give you more details on some of the way we're trying to address that issue. But as a general matter, we welcome foreign investment in the United States. We think it's a good thing for the economy and a good thing globally.
One of the things that happens when you get active current administration officials is sometimes in the middle of the talk you'll get handed a note explaining that they need to leave a little early, as we just did. So we will take a couple more questions if we could make them succinct, and then we will thank the Assistant Secretary right here. And then maybe before you even answer, we'll take Mike Kraft, okay. Keep the questions succinct, and then we'll...
Great, thank you.
Joe Jamali with the Lebanese Information Center. I have a specific question about Hezbollah. Now, we know that Hezbollah is able to sustain itself because of the flow of weapons, but also the flow of money from abroad, mainly Iran and sometimes private donors as well. Do you think there's anything more that the Lebanese government can do to curtail that flow of money? And have you talked to them about that?
We do have a lot of contact with the Lebanese government. I think their FIU is actually one of the leaders in the region. Obviously, there's a political situation there as far as getting a government fully established and so forth. That far be it from me standing here right now to try to give them advice at the moment. What I can say is we're trying to do our part with what we can do with respect to Hezbollah financing, and they do have some capable authorities there, and hopefully we can get kind of the government situation resolved there so that. That they could move forward kind of building their institutions within Lebanon.
Mike Kraft, former State Department Counterterrorism Office. You mentioned UN Security Council Resolution 1373 with yes. All work for helping strengthen their ability to counterterrorism funding. But many observers feel that since the British Ambassador Greenstock left, that the UN Counterterrorism Committee has pretty well gone flabby and downhill. And wondering what your assessment is, because that was supposed to be the framework for helping other countries beef up their laws on regulations on terrorism financing. And another coordination issue, the U.S. government has its own bilateral programs. You touched on with State Justice and Treasury. At least when I was there, some of my State Department colleagues felt that Treasury was not always in sync with state going, pushing different countries, that the Office of Technical Assessment was freelancing on the Hill. What's your assessment of the coordination efforts to get everybody on the same sheet? And is there sufficient funding for this effort?
Okay. On the 1373 context, I guess I would say at the outset, it's a much more difficult problem. It just for folks that aren't as familiar, the 1267 committee and that group looks at Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. And there is, you know, global unanimity about the threat that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban pose. And so, and there is a list-based system there as far as identifying people and entities. And it's a much more simple process to implement obligations that say, here is a list, here are the kinds of restrictions that need to be placed, and put those in place, particularly where, like you say, you have this political consensus about what the target is. 1373 is a very similar resolution that would apply to kind of any other terrorist group, and it really calls on states to have national authorities to be able to take some of those same 1267-like actions against other groups, but the other groups are undefined. And given the historical situation, the political history of different countries and regions, defining kind of who goes into that basket has proven very difficult for a number of jurisdictions. So I would say at the outset that the team, that committee, has a much more difficult job. We have met with them and will continue to work with them, as well as there's a 1267 monitoring team that plays a similar role in the 1267 context, their role being evaluating countries for compliance, trying to provide technical assistance and guidance. And I would agree with you that both of those committees are important tools that we need to try to strengthen. I would just say that 1373 committee has a difficult job starting out.
Please join me in thanking Assistant Secretary O'Brien for joining us, and thank you for taking your time.